It's Purvis now, actually, I said awkwardly. I'm married.
That does sound serious, Cocky said.
Well, not to worry. You're in very capable hands here. She clasped one of my arms and one of Blix's conspiratorially.
Dr. Turvey has sent a prescription, Blix said, and medicinally speaking, I'd say we're in the clear.
Dr. Turvey? I laughed. Is he your private physician?
His imaginary private physician, Cocky said, shaking her head. But I'll say one thing for Turvey. He always does come through.
As we found a corner near the dance floor and settled ourselves, I watched the swirl of bright faces and hoped Jock would be entertained enough by Dee's liquor to give me a few more minutes of peace. Blix had the waiter bring 3 silver buckets and 3 bottles of pink champagne.
So none of us have to share if we don't want to, he said.
It's his leonine territorialism, Cocky explained. Our Blix is a marvelous hunter. It's because he has their instincts.
It's better than working, he agreed. I'm just back from the Belgian Congo, up in the O'Ele. There are legends about elephants with 4 tusks. They have special names for them there, and any number of stories about the mysterious powers they possess. A wealthy client of mine had heard about them, and offered me double my usual rate if we saw one. We didn't even have to shoot it, he said. He only wanted to see one in his lifetime.
And did you see one?
He gave me a funny look and took a long pull on his glass.
She doesn't know how to listen to stories, this one.
You have to let him draw it out, darling. Otherwise he doesn't look half so brave or interesting.
Exactly so. He winked at her. We were out for 3 weeks in the Ituri forest along the sticky marshes of the Congo. Sometimes you can go for months without seeing elephants, but we saw several dozen, and 3 or 4 of them great hulking males with ivory dragging the ground. They were perfect specimens, I tell you, but all 2 tuskers. Meanwhile, my client was growing restless. The longer we stayed in the bush, the more certain he was that there was no such thing, and that we were out to hoodwink him and take his money.
You are there to take his money, Blicky darling.
Of course, but honestly, or as honestly as possible, he grinned. The elephants do exist. I've seen photographs of them slain. So had the client, but being out for so long does funny things to you. I became more and more dodgy to him by the hour, and he did everything but accuse me of wanting to kill him in his sleep. One day, he simply had enough and called the whole thing off.
A month out for nothing, Cocky exclaimed. These people are getting more absurd all the time.
Yes, but richer too, and there's the rub. The money makes you think anything's worth it. But we'd taken 50 porters with us. They had to be paid somehow, and I was worried he'd lost his sense entirely and wouldn't foot the bill when the time came. He shook his head. Anyway, we were on our way back when we spotted the strangest thing. A lone bull, off by himself, at the edge of a lake, sleeping with his head on a giant anthill and snoring like nobody's business.
The 4-tusked phantom, I guessed.
Something even stranger.
Blix smiled his most winning boy's smile.
A 3-tusker. The only one ever sighted, as far as I know. The left tusk had grown double, you see, from the same socket at the root. It was the most extraordinary thing.
He must have been in ecstasy.
The client? You'd think so. But no.
It's deformed, he kept saying.
Of course it was deformed. Some sort of hereditary malformation, probably. But he was so put off, he didn't even want to photograph it.
You've got to be joking, Cocky said.
No, that's just it.
He flicked the side of his glass to make his point.
They want things only so wild.
Real nature terrifies them. It's too unpredictable.
Well, I hope you got your money, Cocky said.
I nearly didn't, he said. But then we became mysteriously lost on the way back to town, with very little water.
I'll bet, Cocky laughed. You do tell wonderful stories, darling.
Do I? I'll go and get more of them for you if you like.
He gave her a familiar look, the two of them locking eyes in a way that told me, if they weren't lovers yet, they would be very soon.
I'll just go and freshen up, I said. Send the waiter, will you? I don't want to run dry here.
Does Dr. Turvey send a new prescription every time? I asked. Or will the old one do?
Ha! I like this one, he said to Cocky. She's got real potential.
My plan was to return to Eastleigh without anyone noticing, but I wasn't halfway to the door before I spotted Jock barreling towards me, his eyes glassy.
What's the big idea, Beryl?
He barked.
I've been looking for you everywhere.
I just slipped out for some air. Where's the crime in that?
We're in town. How does it look if I'm twiddling my thumbs, waiting for you, and you're nowhere to be found?
He reached for my arm, his grip not at all subtle. I haven't done anything wrong. This was my day, after all.
I twisted out of his grip, noticing that several people around us were glancing our way curiously. It made me feel braver. Surely the attention would make him back down.
Lower your voice, he warned. But I'd had enough. As he reached for my arm again, I wrenched myself free and nearly flattened Boy Long in the process.
I hadn't even seen him. Glancing between Jock and me quickly, gauging the situation, Boy said,
Is everything all right here? We're fine, aren't we, Beryl?
Jock said. I had never loved him, it was true. But now I couldn't remember even liking Jock. I was only exhausted, all the way through me.
Go to bed.
He stared me down. I think he was surprised I was standing up to him.
You heard her, Boy said. Time to call it a night. This isn't any of your business.
A knot along Jock's square jaw twitched. His mouth had hardened into a line.
Your wife happens to work for me, so I'd say it is.
I was sure Jock was going to lunge for Boy. He was much the taller and broader man, and could have wrecked Boy without trying. But some tide inside him turned, like a switch going off, and he thought better of it for the moment.
You should be careful, Beryl, he said icily, without taking his eyes from Boy's face.
Then he stormed away.
Charming, Boy said when Jock had gone, but I could hear that his voice wasn't entirely steady.
Thanks for sticking your neck out for me. Can I buy you a drink? I could do with one. We went to the bar for a bottle and some glasses, and then took them out onto one of the low verandas. Over the textured pink wall, I could make out the ghost of the croquet lawn, where brightly painted wickets curved into the grass at intervals, and the post sat waiting for someone's shiny mallet. People passed in and out of the main door, porters and bellmen in white gloves, but we were almost entirely in shadow. I never thought I'd get married, I told Boy as he poured for us. Scotch spilled into the squat glasses with reassuring lapping noises.
I should have left well enough alone. You don't need to explain.
I'm not sure I could, anyway. As we sat in silence for several minutes, I watched his face and hands. Both were mottled grey and soft-looking in the dimness. His earring was the only thing glinting, as if it caught the light from some other time or place.
I've stopped trying to understand people, he said. Horses and sheep make a damned sight more sense.
I nodded. It had always been the same for me.
Do you think I'm silly to want this? Life as a trainer, I mean.
He shook his head. I see you trying to be tough-skinned, but that makes sense. As a woman, you'll have to work twice as hard for everything. I'm not sure I could do it. He lit a cigarette and drew on it, the end flaring red in the dark. When he released the held smoke, he looked at me. I think you're rather brave, actually. Was I brave? I hoped so. I gazed back at him, his thick ivory bracelets, the native-looking piece of bone on a leather thong around his neck, his shirt the color of the sea, when everyone wore khaki. He was such a character, really, but he was here. And I knew he wanted me. I had a split second to consider what I was doing before I reached for his cigarette and put it out against the pale pink wall. He leaned into me, opening my mouth with his tongue smooth and hot. I didn't think of resisting him or about anything else. One of his hands grazed the front of my blouse. The other slipped between my knees with a warm pressure I couldn't help responding to. A hunger for touch, for this, seemed to be coming up from the bottom of me. Maybe it had always been there, sleeping like an animal. I had no idea. I ran my hand along his thigh, twisting into him, and pressed my lips and teeth against his neck. "You're dangerous," he whispered it. "You mean Jock? And you're awfully young. Do you want to stop?" "No." We didn't talk any more that night. Somehow the feel of his skin and his mouth on mine didn't have anything to do with the rest of my life. They had no cost and no consequences. Or so it seemed to me. Night sounds climbed the cool air beyond the veranda wall, and all thought of caution slipped away. Chapter 20. It was late when I got back to Eastleigh. I fell into my cot, feeling too chafed and hard-kissed to sleep, but I did sleep. Just after dawn, I rose to do my work as ever. There was another race to prepare for, and the things that had happened with Boy, and before that, with Jock, had to be swept off to the side of my attention. I wouldn't have known what to do about them anyway. Jock didn't turn up until after my second horse, Shadow Country, had run and came a respectable third. Instead of appearing the way he had the day before, stepping into my limelight, he waited until after the clamour had cleared, and then approached me, as if nothing at all were amiss between us, trailed by Cocky Birkbeck, and a slight, dark-haired fellow, who wasn't a bit like Braw Blixen. He turned out to be her husband, Ben. If I gave Cocky a curious look, she didn't seem rattled. Instead, she congratulated me on the day's race, and then Jock explained that Ben was thinking about getting more seriously into horses, and suggested the four of us get a drink. I was still waiting for the other shoe to drop, for Jock to grab hold of me again, to threaten or warn me, or for him to do something, anything, to suggest he had somehow learned about Boy Long. But it seemed this moment was all about business. "When Ben finds the right horse, you should train him," Jock said, when we were settled with cocktails at a watering hole. "If Delamere will spare you," Ben added. "I'm also keen on your part of the country. There's a plot of land near your place I've had my eye on." We set a date for the couple to come out and have a look at Njoro, and then Cocky made it clear that all this business talk was dull, and we two girls excused ourselves and moved to a table of our own. When we'd settled out of earshot, she said, "Sorry if Blix and I scared you away last night. It's not often we're alone. Being married to other people will do that." She made a face and took off her cloche hat, patting her honey-coloured hair. "We met when he took Ben and me on safari. Blix always seduces the wives if he's given enough time. He likes them trembling with fear, I suppose, at the precipice of mortal danger." She raised a feathery eyebrow. "I don't think he counted on keeping me. But that was almost 2 years ago. That's a long time for things to be so intricate. Does Ben suspect?" "I think so. Not that we have the bad taste to talk about it. He's got his own entanglements too." She gave me a complicated smile. You've heard the joke, haven't you? Are you married or do you live in Kenya? That's funny. I shook my head. And sort of awful, too. Only the day before, Cocky's dark joke wouldn't have included me. But now it did. Is love always such a mess, do you suppose? Maybe not everywhere, but the rules are different here. It's sort of assumed you'll have dalliances or go crazy, but discretion still plays an essential part. You can do anything as long as the right people stay shielded. And the funny thing is, that doesn't always mean your spouse. I absorbed her words slowly, a sobering sort of schooling on the ways of a world that had always resided somewhere else, for other people. And you'll carry on like this? You say it as if I'm doomed. It's not as bad as all that. She reached for the bottle on the table between us and freshened our drinks. Ben isn't hard to manage, but Blix's wife, Karen, likes the title too much to part with it. He's made her a baroness. She sighed. The whole thing has got rather baroque. Karen and I are friends, or were, in any case. Blix asked her for a divorce and told her he was in love with me, probably thinking it would soften the blow. She shook her head. Now she won't speak to me. Why would anyone fight to stay married if they knew the other desperately wanted to leave? I was thinking of Jock, of course. I don't pretend to understand any of it, Cocky breathed. But Karen seems determined to test Blix at every step. I had never been good at sharing my thoughts and feelings the way she was doing so easily. But her openness made me want to try. I also wanted her advice, some bit of wisdom that might help see me through my present tangle. I was too young to get married, I told her, glancing behind me to make sure Jock and Ben were still distracted by each other. Now I'm trying to pull away, but Jock won't hear of it. That must be hard, she said, but honestly, if I hadn't had the bad luck of falling in love, I can't say I'd be keen for a divorce either. You wouldn't want to be free? Just on your own? To do what? Live, I suppose. Make your own choices or mistakes, without anyone telling you what you can and can't do. She shook her head, as if I'd said something absurd. Society does that, darling, even if there isn't a strapping husband on hand. Haven't you learnt that yet? I'm not sure anyone gets what they want. Not really. But you're trying now. I felt exasperated and a little confused. You sound cynical, but you're in love with Blix. I know. Her forehead wrinkled prettily as she frowned. Isn't that the silliest thing you ever heard? When I returned to Soy Sambu the next day, and for weeks afterwards, I continued to puzzle over what Cocky had said, wondering what her situation and bits of guidance actually meant for me. By her estimation, an affair was as de rigueur for the colonists as quinine tablets were for fever, a way to weather or temporarily forget marital unhappiness. But boy wasn't really an affair, was he? What he offered was purer and more animal than what Cocky was embroiled in with Blix, or so I was telling myself. Besides, it felt wonderful. After a year of fumbling and embarrassing encounters with Jock, I was finally learning what sex was, and that I liked it. Boy would come into my cottage at night and wake me by roughly pressing against me, his hands everywhere before I was fully conscious. He had none of Jock's tentativeness, and I found I wasn't shy with him either. I could move any way I liked and not spook him. I could turn him away and not hurt his feelings, because feelings had nothing to do with any of it. One night he found me alone in the stable and led me to an empty loose box without saying a word. Turning me over onto a hay bale, his hands came around to the waist of my cotton shirt and tugged it open roughly. My ribs rocked against the bale, and my teeth caught on bits of hay. Afterwards, he stretched out naked, without a flicker of modesty, his arms crossed behind him. You don't seem like the same girl who snubbed me for several months running. I don't know what sort of girl I am anymore, to tell the truth. I rested one of my hands on his chest, lightly stroking the thatch of springy dark hair. I grew up with the Kipps. For them, sex doesn't get all tangled up with guilt or expectations. It's something you do with your body, like hunting. There are people who tell you we're exactly like the animals. Same appetites, same urges. It's a nice idea. But you don't believe it? I don't know, he said. Someone always seems to get hurt. It shouldn't have to be like that. We have our eyes open, don't we? Of course we do. Your husband's still in the picture, though. Does he have his eyes open? Now you're trying to rub my nose in it. I'm not, he said as he easily pulled me on top of him. How could I be? The following Saturday, when I went home to Njoro, Ben and Cocky's car stood in our yard with luggage strapped to the boot. I parked Dee's wagon behind it and rounded the veranda to see them sitting comfortably at our rattan table in the shade, having cocktails with Jock.
We've saved you some ice, Cocky said.
She wore a loose silk dress and a hat with sheer netting that fell to the bridge of her nose. She looked lovely in it, and I was happy to see her. Her and Ben's company would make my time in Njoro much more bearable than usual. Jock fetched me a drink, a scarlet-laced Pimm's with fresh lemon and orange peel over chipped ice, pretty as a picture. But he had an odd look on his face, and he didn't try to give me his usual perfunctory peck on the cheek. "Everything all right?" I asked. "Yes." He didn't meet my eyes.
"You've really done wonders with the place," Ben said.
Before turning to ranching, he had been a major in the King's African Rifles, and there was something military about him still, a precision and a clipped composure, with neatly trimmed dark hair and fine, straight features. He was considerably better looking than Blix, but I already guessed he didn't have Blix's humor or his sense of adventure.
"Jock is the miracle worker," I conceded. "There's nothing he can't plow or hammer into place. Except maybe my wife."
He said it easily, almost cheerfully, as though the barb were harmless. Ben and Cocky laughed, and I tried to join them. I'd never been good at reading Jock, and certainly wasn't now that we were living apart.
"We just bought the parcel next door," Cocky said. "We'll have to play bridge at the weekends. I adore cards," she went on, "though Ben here would rather eat knives."
Barasa came to refill our ice bucket, and we all had another while the sun rose a little higher in the sky, but I couldn't shake the distinct feeling that something was off with Jock. Maybe he was punishing me for the scene at the Matega, when he'd stormed away half-pissed. Maybe the whole facade of our arrangement was finally starting to wear and crack. Whatever was happening, Cocky clearly felt it too. When the four of us headed over to admire their new property before dinner, she clasped my elbow, letting the men get well ahead of us.
"Is there something you want to tell me?" she asked quietly.
"I don't know," I said. I didn't, but by the time we settled before the fire later that evening, things became clearer as they unraveled. Jock drank too much at dinner, and his eyes took on a troubling sheen. I recognized this as a kind of warning, the first stone along the path to a good row, and hoped he would think twice with the Birkbecks here.
"How will you follow up your success for the next race meeting?" Ben asked from the sofa, while the fire made cheerful crinkling noises. "Care to share some of your secrets?"
"When I train your horses, I'll share all of them," I said. Ben laughed thinly. It seemed he'd felt the tension in the room too, and now was trying to plot a strategic way to safely steer us back on course. He rose and made a sweep of the room.
"I say, Jock, but this is a beauty."
He meant the broad, smooth Arab door that Jock had bought for the house not long after we were married. Like the phonograph, it was a sign of prosperity, and Jock was proud of it. The wood of the door was a rich puzzle of knots, with an overlay of carvings the artisan had painstakingly worked into the surface.
"It's lovely," Cocky said. "Wherever did you find it?"
"Lamu," Jock said. "I've been thinking of improving it, though."
"What?" she laughed. "It's a relic, isn't it? You wouldn't really touch it."
"I might."
He slid over the last word strangely, his tongue too thick and uncontrolled. He was drunker than I thought.
"Let's have a game."
I reached for the deck of cards, but Jock wasn't listening. He strode out of the room only long enough for Cocky to give me a questioning look, and then came back again with a wooden mallet he'd found in the kitchen. It was a kitchen tool, meant for tenderizing meat, but he was beyond caring about proper uses. While we watched, he dragged over a chair and climbed on top of it to pound a small copper peg into the upper right-hand corner of the door with the mallet, hammering away.
"Every time my wife has an indiscretion, I'm going to add a nail," he said to the door.
I couldn't see his expression and couldn't bear to look at Cocky or Ben.
"It might be the only way we'll be able to keep track."
"Good God, Jock," I cried, horrified. Somehow he'd learned about Boy then, and this was how he was exacting revenge, with an all-out scene in front of new friends. When he whirled round with the mallet, it balanced in his hand for a moment like a rungu club, his eyes glittering.
"Get down."
"Just one by my count. Is that right?" he asked me, and then turned to Ben. "Unless you've had her too."
"Stop!"
I yelled, as Cocky's face went deathly white. One of Jock's knees buckled, and he tipped off the chair, tumbling to the floor. The mallet flew away from him, whipping over my left shoulder, and bouncing with a thuddering clatter off the window casement. Thank goodness for instincts. I had ducked at precisely the right moment. Another few inches, or portion of a second, and the mallet would have cracked me on the head. Then we really would have had a story. As Jock scrambled to find his feet again, Ben hurried to Cocky, and they made for the other room just as Barassa arrived.
"Please help Bwana to bed," I told him,
and soon I could hear them in the other room, a thump of shoes and shuffling of bedclothes. When I found the Birkbecks, they told me they were heading back to town. I was mortified.
"At least wait till morning," I said. "It will be safer then."
"We're nothing if not intrepid," Cocky said gently. She signaled to Ben to go and pack their things, and when he'd gone, she said, "I don't know what you've done, darling, but I can tell you there are things men don't want to know. And with us here, too."
"I suppose he had to show you he was still in charge."
"You don't mean to say he was justified in acting that way?"
"No," she sighed, but it seemed as if she was saying precisely that. "I'm a disaster at marriage, and now at infidelity, too?"
She laughed soberly. "None of this is easy, I know. You're so young, and everyone makes great lurching mistakes sometimes. You really will work it out one day. For now, though, you've got to eat humble pie." I walked them out, and after their Ford's quavering headlamps had passed from sight, I was alone with the southern stars. How had I got here exactly? The shadowy Aberdares were the same as they had ever been, and the forest sounds, too. And yet I wasn't. I'd forgotten myself. I'd let one dodgy, fearful choice roll into another, somehow thinking that through this twisting and sticky route, I could still arrive at freedom. Arap Maina would have clucked and shaken his head to see me. Lady D would have gazed at me with those wise grey eyes of hers and said, "What? That I had to eat humble pie?" I didn't think so. And what of my father? He had raised me to be strong and self-sufficient. And I wasn't that now, not by a long shot. From somewhere nearby, a hyena whined, high and breathy, and another answered. The night pushed at me from all its edges. It seemed I could either walk into Jock's house and close the door and continue with this nonsense, or I could plunge out into the dark with no map for what happened next. Jock could come after me in a full-blown rage for smearing his name. Friends and neighbors might slowly and subtly turn away or snub me for breaking rank, the way they had with Mrs. O. I might never see my horses again, or might go completely broke, trying to find my way without Jock's support. I could fail in so many ways, but even so, there was no choice, really. When I went into the house again, I turned down all the lamps and padded to my room in the dark. Soundlessly, I packed my few things quickly and was on my way before midnight. Chapter 21. Do you think Jock will come after me? Boy asked when I recounted the whole story back at Soy Sambu. Now that he knows about us. Why would he? His whole argument has been about keeping up appearances and avoiding gossip. If anything, he'll make my life harder, or dig in more about the divorce. We were in my cottage after dark. It was a cool night, and as I warmed my hands against the chimney of the hurricane lantern, Boy's face remained clouded over with his thoughts. He seemed unsettled and out of place, though he'd been in my room dozens of times. "And what about us?" he finally asked. "What do you mean? We've had a few laughs, haven't we? I don't see why anything should change." "I only wondered." He cleared his throat and pulled the Somali blanket more snugly around his shoulders. There are women who'd be expecting a fella to step up and get serious at some point. "Is that what you're worried about? I can't seem to get rid of the husband I've got. And anyway, what I'd really like to know is how it feels to be on my own. Not someone's daughter or wife, I mean, but my own person." "Oh." It seemed I'd surprised him. "There isn't a lot of that kind of thinking round here." "Of course there is," I told him, trying to draw a smile. "It's just usually a man who's doing it." Now that I wouldn't have to keep up the ruse of weekend wife, I had more time and energy for my horses and was ready to give them my all. The St. Ledger was an event for three-year-olds and Kenya's most illustrious stakes race. Dee had a few promising contenders, but the best of the lot was ringleader, a satin black and high-stepping gelding. He was a real horse, and Dee was offering me a chance to train him. But he'd got a leg, as they say in horse speak. Before he'd come to Soy Sambu, he'd been overtrained, and his tendons had become sensitive, with a tendency to swell. With plenty of care and patience, though, he could still come back. He'd need soft, forgiving soil, so I took him down to the shore of El Menteta and did all his galloping there along the moist edge, while nearby herds of eland looked on curiously and hordes of flamingos stirred over the lake's surface and settled, squawking the same alarm over and over. Late one afternoon, I was coming back from a training session there, my clothes and hair flecked with bits of dried mud, when I ran into Barclay Cole again. It had been 2 years since my coming-out party. That night he and Dennis Finch Hatton had recited poetry for me in blindingly white coats, both of them with manners like something out of a book about knights and gallantry. Now he'd driven over with a few other settlers to meet Dee about some recent political nonsense. I happened to find him out for a smoke, leaning against a length of fence railing, as the last of the sun vanished behind him. His collar was loose, and his auburn hair hatless and slightly windblown. It was almost as if someone had sketched him there.
"The last time we met, you weren't long out of pigtails," he said, after we'd recognized each other. "Now you're all over the papers. Your jubilant was impressive."
I felt myself squirm slightly under his praise. "I didn't ever wear pigtails, actually. Couldn't sit still long enough for them." He smiled.
"It hasn't seemed to hurt you much. And you've married?"
Not knowing quite how to describe my current state, I hedged. In a manner of speaking, in the several weeks since the terrible scene with the Birkbecks and the Arab door, I hadn't heard a peep from Jock. I'd written to him making it plain that I wanted a divorce and wouldn't back down, but he hadn't answered me. Maybe that was all right, though. It was a relief simply to be in our separate corners. In a manner of speaking? Barclay's mouth twisted in a way that was both wry and slightly paternal, but he didn't press me further. What's tea getting you wrapped up in? I gestured towards the house. From the booming of Dee's voice, things sounded fairly volatile.
I'm afraid to know all of it. Vigilance committee guff.
Ah, maybe you'd better run. Dee had formed the committee a few months before, part of a new effort to combat the old problem of just who had a right to Kenya and why. White settlers had always been keen on self-rule, which amounted to something more like total domination of the territory. They saw Indians and Asians as outliers, to be fought off with sticks, if necessary. Africans were fine, as long as they remained clear about their inferior state, and didn't want too much land. But recently, the British government had issued the Devonshire White Paper, a series of declarations meant to beat back the white settlers' greedy demands and restore something like order in the colony. We had a new governor, Sir Robert Corrindon, and he was taking the White Paper awfully seriously. Though he was as British as could be, from his starched collar to his gleaming Oxfords, he was pro-Asian and pro-African, a loud and fearless champion for both groups, where the previous governor had been malleable and cheerful and benign. Because things had swung in the white settlers' favor for so long, they could only be enraged now and think of how to fight back, even if that involved force. Not surprisingly, Dee was the fiercest among them.
I'm actually relieved I've been out of the country for most of this past year, Barclay explained.
Then he told me how he'd been in London, seeing a slew of doctors for his heart. Oh no, what did they say?
Nothing good, I'm afraid. The damned thing's been troubling me for years.
What will you do now?
Live until it gives me away, of course, and drink only the best champagne. There's not time for anything else.
His face was delicate and sensitive-looking, like a well-bred cat's. He also had rich brown eyes that seemed to want to laugh at the idea of sadness or self-pity. He flicked away his cigarette and cleared his throat.
I'm throwing myself a birthday party next week, he said. One of the many ways I'm whistling past the graveyard these days. I'll bet you're a grand whistler, aren't you? Please come.
Barclay had settled on the lower slopes of Mount Kenya, in Naro Moro. He'd built a broad stone bungalow right up against the curves of the mountain, so it seemed to belong there and nowhere else. There were paddocks full of well-fed sheep and a winding river surrounded by thorn trees and twisting yellow witch hazel. Kenya's crags loomed over everything, looking deeply black up close, full-shouldered and imposing, and also perfect somehow. Exactly what Barclay should have looking after him, I thought. Dee came along to the party as well. When we motored up, a drove of automobiles crisscrossed the lawn and drive. Barclay was out on the veranda in a smart white tailcoat, humming snatches of a tune I didn't recognize. His color was high, and he seemed to be in the peak of health, though I guessed that, like his lovely suit, it was put on. It probably mattered a great deal to him to appear to be the perfect host, and dazzlingly well, too, no matter how things really were or felt beneath the surface. Your river is gorgeous. I leaned through a cloud of clean-smelling hair tonic to kiss his cheek. It was gleaming with fish when we crossed it.
Glad you're keen on the trout. I couldn't get a proper goose for dinner.
He winked.
Now, come get some champagne before Dennis swills it all.
Dennis. Though I'd only met him briefly on the street in Nairobi, For some reason my heart jumped at the sound of his name. We crossed the veranda and entered the main room of the house, which was full of people and the sound of laughter. And there he was in a languid slouch against the wall, hands in the pockets of his nice white trousers. He was as tall as I remembered, and just as lovely to look at.
"Beryl Purvis," Barclay said. "You've met the Honourable Denis Finch Hatton."
I felt my face go warm as I reached for his hand. "Long ago."
"Of course,"
he smiled, the lines around his eyes deepening. But his tone was so light, it wasn't clear if he remembered me at all, even vaguely.
"Nice to see you. Denis has been at home, in London, for far too long," Barclay said.
"What will you do now that you're back in Kenya?"
"That's an excellent question. I might do some land developing. Titch Miles thinks we can form a legitimate company."
He smiled, as if legitimate were a pleasant surprise in this context.
"And I've been dying to do some hunting."
"Why not?" Dee broke in. "The world is clamoring for more great white hunters."
"You should know," Denis laughed at him. "You invented the term."
"Yes, well, I never guessed who'd come galumphing over to Kenya, hungry for trophies. Two or three times a month, some rich banker shoots himself in the leg, or offers himself up to a lion. It's absurd."
"Maybe that sort deserves what they get," I said. "If they don't have the slightest idea of what they're up against, I mean, or even what it means to kill an animal."
"You're probably right," Denis agreed. "I've only hunted for myself so far. I'm not sure I'd have the patience for clients."
"What's wrong with farming?" Barclay wanted to know. "It's a good deal safer without bloody hyenas, or what have you, trying to nibble off your face in the middle of the night."
"Safer?" Denis repeated.
He had the look of a schoolboy, suddenly, ready for a prank.
"Explain the fun in that."
Denis seemed a few years younger than Barclay, somewhere near 35, I guessed, and just as well born. In my experience, these sorts of men usually launched into Africa, lured by virgin territory, big game, or a sense of adventure. They were the sons of British aristocrats who had been sent to the very best schools and given every advantage and freedom. They came to Kenya and used their birthright fortunes to buy up thousands of acres. Some were serious at putting down roots and making a life here, like Barclay, while others were playboys who had grown bored in Sussex or Shropshire and were looking for a bit of trouble. I didn't know which Denis was, but I liked looking at him. He had a wonderful face, a little pink from the sun, with a sharp, strong nose, full lips, and heavily lidded, hazel eyes. There was an ease and a confidence in him, too, that seemed to pull the room towards him, as if he were its anchor or axis. After I had walked away, sipping at my drink and listening to bits of gossip here and there, a clutch of pretty women appeared to swoop down on him, most of them polished to a sheen. They wore nice frocks and stockings and jewels, and had hair that behaved. I could see they were all drawn to him, but that wasn't exactly surprising. I was too.
"You should have a look at my new horse," Barclay said,
stepping up to me with a fresh cocktail.
"I think he's Derby material."
"Wonderful," I agreed automatically. And before I knew it, we'd collected Denis and headed to the stable, where half a dozen horses were turned out in their loose boxes. The one we'd come to see was Soldier, a big and rangy dark bay, with a white moon for a blaze. He wasn't as proud-looking or fiery as the thoroughbreds my father had always loved, but I found him handsome in a rough way, and was instantly intrigued. "He's a half-breed, then?" I asked Barclay, as the three of us approached the stall.
"Part Somali pony, I think. Not high-born, but you can see he's got spirit."
Opening the gate, I moved towards Soldier the way I'd learned as a child. Gently, but firmly. My father had passed his touch with animals on to me, or maybe I'd been born with it. Soldier felt my authority and didn't shy or even step back as I passed my hands over his back and rump and hocks. He was sound and strong. From his place at the gate, I felt Dennis watching me. The skin along the back of my neck prickled from the attention, but I didn't look up.
"What do you think?" Barclay asked.
"He's got something," I had to concede.
"What's he worth to you?"
As broke as I was, I knew I shouldn't even pretend to bargain, but it was in my blood.
"$50?" "I spent more than that on the champagne you've been drinking."
Though he and Dennis both laughed, I could tell Barclay loved to haggle too.
"You should see him run. Let me get one of the grooms to take him out for you."
"Don't bother," I told him. "I'll ride him myself." It didn't take me 5 minutes to borrow trousers and change. When I came out of the house, a number of people had gathered on the lawn, and though Barclay laughed to see me in his clothes, I knew they fitted me well, and I didn't have to feel embarrassed about riding in front of this well-born crowd. Being on horseback was as natural as walking for me, perhaps more so. I nudged Soldier away from the onlookers, and soon forgot everything else. Behind Barclay's paddock, a dirt lane led past a few tin-roofed farm buildings and down a slope to a small clearing with bits of scrub. I rode over and eased Soldier into an extended trot. His back was wide, and his sides were as rounded and easy as a comfortable chintz-covered chair. It wasn't clear that he could really run, but Barclay had insisted on it, so I nudged him faster. Instantly, his hind and forelegs quickened. In a canter, his stride was fluid and powerful, and his neck relaxed. I'd forgotten how much fun it could be to ride a new animal, to feel power climbing up into my hands from the leather reins and into my legs through Soldier's body. I urged him even faster, and he stretched from his center, his muscles in balance, beginning to fly. Then, quick as a string breaking, he froze. Mid-stride, his forelegs plunged down stiffly, and I swung forward over his withers like a cracked whip. Before I could recover, he reared and twisted sideways, whinnying with a sharp cry. I was in the air, thrown hard on my side, my teeth jarred against my tongue. I tasted blood as my hip exploded with pain. Beside me, Soldier squealed and reared again. I flinched, knowing he could crush me, but a moment later he bolted cleanly away. Only then did I see the snake. About 15 feet from where I lay, it was coiled over itself like fat black ribbon, and it was locked on me. When I startled, the top part of its long body shot up, elastically, with dizzying speed. Its pale striped neck widened into a kind of cape. It was a cobra, I knew. We didn't have them in Njoro, and I had never seen this type exactly, with zebra-like coloring and an arrow-shaped head. But my father had told me many types of cobra could stretch their body length in a single strike. Some could spit venom, too, but most snakes didn't want a confrontation. A twisted piece of mahogany lay only a few inches from my hand. I would try to reach for it and brandish the stick out in front of me to block a strike if one came. I readied myself, watching the movement of its head. The hard, glassy eyes were like small black beads. Hovering, the snake trained on me too, its pale tongue darting and tasting the air. I steadied my breath and, as slowly as I could manage, sent my hand out towards the stick.
"Don't move,"
I heard suddenly from behind me. There'd be no footsteps, at least not that I could hear, but the cobra reared up even higher. Half its body flared from the ground, its belly glazed with yellowish slashes. Its hood breathed open. This was the only warning as it whipped forward. I pinched my eyes shut, my arms flying over my head as I scrabbled backwards. At the same moment, a shot rang out. The charge hit so close I felt it vibrate through my skull. My ears rang. Even before the explosive sound had cleared the air, Dennis strode forward and shot again. Both shots landed, the second one catching the snake in the neck so that it jumped sideways. Bits of flesh spat into the dust with bright splashes of its blood. When it was still, he turned to me coolly. "Are you all right?"
"I think so."
When I stood, pain erupted through my side and along my hip. My knee was throbbing and didn't want to take my weight.
"That type doesn't shrink from trouble, you know. It's good you didn't do anything stupid."
"How did you even find me?"
"I saw the horse come back alone and thought, I'll bet she doesn't fall for no reason. After that, I just followed the dust."
He was so calm, so matter-of-fact.
"You sound as if you do this sort of thing every day."
"Not every day." He smiled crookedly.
"Shall we go back?"
Though I probably could have managed on my own, Dennis told me I should lean on him. Against the side of his body, I smelled his warm cotton shirt and his skin, and felt how solid and sound he was. And he'd been so clear-headed when he took aim. He hadn't thought about anything else, only acted. It wasn't often I'd seen that level of self-possession in a man. We came to the house all too soon. Barclay rushed out, mortified and alarmed, while Dee knitted his eyebrows together, paternally.
"What the hell do you think you're doing, risking my best trainer?" he shot at Barclay.
"I'm fine," I told them both. "There was hardly anything to it at all." Dennis downplayed the moment too, almost as if we had agreed on it without speaking. He said nothing of his own bravery, and behaved as if the whole ordeal were commonplace. That impressed me, and how for the rest of that day we didn't mention what had happened again. But the memory lent a palpable charge to the hours, as if there were an invisible length of string or wire between us. We talked of other things, how much he still thought about his years at Eton, how he'd found Kenya by chance in 1910, meaning to settle in South Africa instead. "What was it that drew you?" I asked him.
"About Kenya? Nearly everything. I think I'd always been looking for an escape route."
"Escape from what?"
"I don't know. Any tight-fitting definition of what a life should be, I suppose. Or what I should be in it."
I smiled.
"Should isn't a word that suits you, is it? Worked that one out already, did you?"
"It's never been one of my favorite words either." Our eyes met for a moment, and I felt a spark of perfect understanding. Then Barclay sailed up, and the two friends started talking about the war, how they'd enlisted in a scouting party near the border of German East Africa and Kilimanjaro.
"We weren't very glorious, I'm afraid," Dennis said, sketching it in for me. "Most of our casualties came from tsetse fly and bush rat stew."
It was almost a kind of dance, how funny and clever these two were together, lighter than air. Before long we were all a little drunk from the champagne we'd been swilling, and it had got quite late.
"Let's take a few bottles over to Bagani," Dennis said suddenly to Barclay. "The Baroness is on her own tonight."
"Baroness?" The word jangled. Cocky Birkbeck had used it in the Norfolk, the day she told me about Blix's situation and his wife.
"I can't leave my own party," Barclay said. "It's too late anyway, and you're in no state to drive." "I have a mother, thank you very much." Dennis turned his back on Barclay and fixed on me. "Want to go for a ride into the country, Beryl?"
Barclay shook his head, warning me off. I stood there for a moment, wondering how serious Dennis was, and whether they were in fact speaking of Blix's wife. But before I could begin to sort it out or say a word, Dennis strode over to the bar, wrestled three bottles of champagne into his arms, and was on his way out of the door. Barclay laughed. I was dumbstruck.
"Good night,"
Dennis sang back over his shoulder before passing out of sight.
"Shall we have one more nip and turn in?" Barclay asked.
I still hadn't caught up.
"What just happened?"
"Merely Dennis
being Dennis."
he said, mysteriously, and reached for my hand. Chapter 22 Dee and I stayed over at Barclay's that night, camping out on thick rafts of Somali-made quilts, with a handful of other tipsy guests. Every time I rolled over, I felt the sore place on my hip, and Dennis's image flickered up like a new ghost. But when it was time to leave the next day, he still hadn't returned. Somehow that made me even more curious about him. The moment with the cobra might have worked to cement us in a strange way. Or maybe Dennis was just nicer to look at, and more confident than almost any man I'd ever met. Either way, I was already thinking of how good it would be to see him again.
"You'll let Dennis know I said goodbye?"
I asked Barclay, as Dee went off to fetch the wagon for us.
"Hmm?"
He gave me a curious look.
"Please tell me you haven't fallen for Finch Hatton too, darling."
"Don't be silly."
I felt myself flush.
"I like him, that's all."
"Is that so?"
He stroked his moustache. "I've never known a woman who could resist him. They fall for him by the dozens, but he never seems to fall for anyone."
"No one?"
He shrugged. "Desperately sorry about the business with the horse, by the way. You won't hold it against me, I hope."
"Of course not.
I'd buy him if I could, but Jock holds the purse strings, and I'm trying to be done with all that. With marriage, I mean. I haven't quite known how to talk about it. I've been wondering what's going on between the two of you, what with your working for Dee and all." His voice was kind, not judgmental, as I had feared. "It's not so common for women in the colony to stray far from their duties, I suppose." He shook his head. "Send word if you need anything. Or whistle," he added, smiling.
"I will,"
I assured him, and then Dee roared up with the wagon, and we were away. Ringleader's training was coming along bit by bit. He had the right breeding to win, and the right nerves, too. If only his legs would heal properly. I continued to exercise him along the mud-soft shoreline of El Mentator, liking the time to myself as well. Even with the flamingos, it was far less chaotic there than at the ranch. I always felt myself grow calmer as I connected to Ringleader's movements, his stride, and also to the rich landscape around us. The lake formed a shallow basin that opened up to green savanna in every direction. Low and knobby hill formations sprang up here and there, and the swooping lines of the mountain called the Sleeping Warrior. Its reflection was often painted perfectly on the flat surface of the lake and studded with flamingos at rest, like a fan of bright jewels. It was beautiful country, and though none of it moved me as much as Njoro did, Soy Sambu was beginning to grow on me, and even to feel like a place where I could happily stay. One day, after I had run Ringleader to the edge of his gallop, encouraged by his growing strength and confidence, I saw a car coming over land from a few miles away, pointing as straight at Soy Sambu as the crow flies. I didn't know who might be bold enough to leave the main road. It had rained on and off for several days, and the tires were kicking up pellets of mud, sending a large group of eland zigzagging off over the bush. When the vehicle drew nearer, I recognized Dennis. His machine was built like a rhinoceros, with heavy mud-painted tires. I tethered Ringleader so he wouldn't startle, and went on foot to meet him as he came round the lake. The ground around the shore had gone boggy, and as his car idled, the tires sank slowly into the muck. Dennis didn't seem remotely concerned.
"The road not fine enough for you today?"
I asked him.
"You never know who you'll run into this way."
He cut the motor and pushed off his hat, squinting up at me.
"I saw you flying along the shore when I came up over the rise. I didn't know it was you, but it was beautiful to watch. Thrilling, actually.
My horse is really starting to come along. I felt something new in him today. Maybe that's what you saw." Free of his helmet, Dennis's sparse brown curls were matted with sweat. Small flecks of mud had spattered along his forehead and cheek.